The Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project was produced in association with the 3rd Annual Institute of African Studies Conference and Feshrift in honor of Linda Freeman, Solidarity and Shifting Patterns of Hegemony in Southern Africa, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives, which was held on March 1st and 2nd, 2018, at Carleton University. This Oral Histories Project consists of interviews with participants of the conference, including activists, aid workers, diplomats, and politicians, who volunteered to discuss their personal experiences as part of the anti-apartheid movement in Canada. The interviews were conducted by Susan Bazilli, PhD student at the University of British Columbia, and by myself, Michael Buchert, a PhD student at Carleton University. In this interview, Judith Marshall sat down with me to talk about her experiences as a co-founder of the Toronto Committee for the Liberation of Southern Africa. This was recorded on March 2nd, 2018, at Carleton University.
My name is Judith Marshall, and I am now retired after many years of doing work internationally. If I had to pin down a description of my work, I guess it would be some mix of scholar, activist, and longtime educator in many different settings, never in a public school system, but with labor education and community organizations.
When did you first hear about the situation in South Africa, and what shaped your thinking about it?
I grew up in Winnipeg, and then after a first university degree there, went and studied theology in New York, and was there at the time of the Sharpeville Massacre, and I think the beginnings of a glimmer of Africa as a place of enormous unrest and enormous injustice was in my mind. I was at Union Theological Seminary, so I think I came away from those and worked in East Harlem, so issues around racism and around the history of black history were very much in my mind from that, and I came out of those years at Union Theological Seminary and in New York in those years with, I guess, a grounding in liberation theology on the one hand and New Left politics on the other, and those have both continued to be foundations of the kind of work I've done over the years.
And then how did you start to get involved in anti-apartheid initiatives?
Well, after those years in New York, I had gone to Ghana and worked in Volta River Project in Ghana for several years, a big hydroelectric scheme, 80,000 people resettled, largest man-made lake in the world, supposed to be the beginnings of industrialization. And I think this really got me into African politics. I mean, this was meant to be, well, Ghana, the first country to become independent, and huge hydroelectric scheme that was to use Ghana's bauxite to create an integrated aluminum industry. And I was there dealing with a link to a project looking at the social side of it. But in the end, what that project did was to make it possible for two American aluminum companies, Reynolds and a second one, name of which I forget for the moment, produce the lowest cost aluminum in the world. And Ghana was left with this huge man-made lake, 80,000 people resettled in 52 resettlement towns all around the lake, Jamaican bauxite rather than Ghana's bauxite. And it was sort of a situation that has since repeated itself many times, aspirations for a national economic development strategy, an industrial strategy, and some part of an investment that would create jobs. And in the end, the big profit going to some transnational corporation. So I sort of rubbed my nose in that reality at a very young point in my life. But that certainly put the question of Africa and decolonization firmly on my agenda. I subsequently did a master's thesis at the Institute of Social Studies in The Hague and did a thesis about the development of underdevelopment in Ghana using underdevelopment theory that was popular in the day, and learning more about South Africa at that point. But then at the end of my time, In Africa, I had traveled to Kenya for a meeting with other people who were in the same program that I was in that had taken me to Ghana. And others there had had assignments at the Mozambique Institute in Dar es Salaam, where the liberation movement in Mozambique, Frelimo, was housed and used as a rear base. And then others who had worked in South Africa. And the realities of anti-apartheid became more firmly placed on my agenda from that. And then I returned to Canada in 1972 to Toronto, although I had grown up in Winnipeg. And I had two names of people that I should look up in Canada when I returned to Toronto. And one of them was John Saul. And so when I contacted him, he said, yes, let's meet. We're just starting a committee to support the liberation struggle in Mozambique. I'm delighted to have you aboard. And so from a return to Canada after many years away, thinking I was jumping into totally the unknown, I found myself immediately amongst friends and comrades with a common interest in things happening in Africa, and so became one of the founding members of TICLSAC back then in 1972.
And what kind of initiatives did TICLSAC undertake at that time?
I mean, it's funny in this current age when terrorists, both real ones and falsely accused ones, are the sort of bogeyman in the government's cupboard. There we were, a totally open committee supporting an armed struggle for liberation in Mozambique. The letterhead of the committee had a woman with a baby in her arms and a gun over her shoulder. And this is our letterhead and our sort of logo for the organization. We were a very open organization. We met weekly, or was it monthly? I can't remember which. But had three working committees. One was the education committee. One was the leverage committee, looking for points of leverage to influence policy decisions in Canada around Mozambique. And the third was the fundraising committee. And in the education committee, our main educational instrument, I mean, I think what we came up with was brilliant, but I can't remember any discussions about whether and how we should do it. But what we came up with was something called Cinema of Solidarity, 8-week cinema series. At that time, third world movies virtually never showed in movie houses. I mean, that's so different today, where such festivals are common. But at that time, that was already a little niche market that we found. Although market denigrates it already, because it became this quite extraordinary experience of Sunday nights for 8 weeks, every spring and every fall, Cinema of Solidarity, week one and week eight, were films about the struggles in Africa, in southern Africa. And then weeks 2 to 7 were just liberation of every kind. And at that time in Toronto, there were many people there as students or for other reasons living there from countries where liberation struggles were ongoing. And so the year after TICLSAC formed, 73, the coup in Chile, an influx of amazing Latin American political exiles, Chileans, but also there had been a number of Brazilians and other Latinos who had gone to Chile to support the process there and were also in exile. There were many people from the Caribbean who subsequently became leaders in important political movements in the Caribbean. There was a handful of Vietnamese living there linked to the struggles in Vietnam. And it, also films about women's struggles or workers' struggles. So every Sunday night, we would pull in 200 to 300 people for our cinema showings and a discussion afterwards with people from these various groupings in the city. So it was a sort of new left politics that came at a particular moment and was really a fascinating process. But that our the committee, I mean, it was a huge draw, mechanism for recruitment into the committee and just to play a role in terms of a larger left and a larger vision of what liberation meant. So I think that was one of the characteristics of Tickle-Sack, was that we weren't narrowly focused on anti-apartheid movements or Africa. I mean, we were focusing on that, but saw it very much in tandem with a variety of other liberation struggles. And I'm really happy to recall that at the point when the Dene Declaration was a very important feature of Indigenous struggles in Canada, that we had an evening focusing on that as well. I don't think we were as conscious of the importance of that as we should have been, but I'm happy to be looking back to find that we did it. So, anyway, that was part of what we did as a committee. The Leverage Committee, the bank campaign, huge. I mean, fun was part of what we characterized the way we worked. So one of the things in the bank campaign was in the era of deposit slips in the bank, so that when you went to make a deposit, you actually had to fill in a little slip that, and they were just there on the counter in the bank. So we all carried these counter slips, I guess I could call them, but a little slip that said, "Don't bank on apartheid," and a little bit about the campaigning there. That was part of the bank campaign. So we all would carry those around with us, and any time we went into the bank, we'd just insert a few of our deposit slips so that the next few customers would get a surprise when they went to make their deposit. So we had anti-imperialist children's festivals, throwing the darts at the bad figures of, in the apartheid regime, and so on and so forth. So family-centered activities. I mean, looking back on it, it was interesting politically in its the variety of things that we did. Our fundraising campaign, for example, at one point was a truck for the liberated areas of Mozambique. And we found a company that made high-quality wooden toys and got them to produce little wooden trucks for us, wooden dump trucks that had Aluta Continua written on the side. So I think looking back on it and thinking about other political experiences over the years that have been boringly earnest, I think the fact that we did it with a lot of verve and a lot of fun. In fact, the RCMP report that John Saul ultimately requested and received that was very heavily redacted, so it was hard to say what all I really thought they were seeing. But one part they didn't black out was to say that these people who were part of Tickle-Sack seemed to spend a lot of time with each other socially as well and seemed to really enjoy each other. And I think that part of the secret of our success is that we really were doing all of this with a huge amount of it was an interesting moment in every way, as you can imagine, with these the fine company we kept in terms of other people as well who were involved in liberation struggles. But it was a hopeful moment in terms of it seemingly was something that made a difference, and Frelimo was doing interesting things in Mozambique, gaining victories, gaining more and more liberated territory, inventing interesting programs in the liberated areas. So, I mean, that really stimulated us in terms of the kind of work we tried to do in Toronto as well.
And at what point did the organization shift to focus more on South Africa specifically?
We started in 72 and 75, the coup, or the 74, the coup in Portugal, and by 75, the independence of Mozambique and Angola. So we began shifting some then and gradually took on more work with the other countries in the region as appropriate. So, I mean, in 1980, Zimbabwe became independent. So from 1980 on, I mean, Namibia was never quite as central, I would say, from 1980 on. I mean, the shift was towards South Africa and more moved in that direction.
And can you tell me more about different partnerships or coalitions that you might have had with other civil society? Or even, did you have any partnerships with government agencies? Or did you work with other people engaged in the anti-apartheid movement?
With government agencies, no. In fact, John Saul, who was one of the founding members, and never short with a funny comment. So when people would ask him if Tickelsack was an NGO, he would say, no, we're not an NGO, we're an AGO, an anti-government organization. But we certainly did not receive government funding in those early days as Tickelsack, although there came a moment, I think we didn't receive this as Tickelsack, but there certainly was a moment when the Canadian government shifted its policy dramatically. And so on the one hand, in that world of NGOs who were recipients of Canadian government money, CETA money, there was a lot of money available for work in the frontline states surrounding South Africa, and then at a certain point for work in South Africa itself. But no, in those years, I mean, we, in terms of our funding, I mean, we, the cinema series was a fundraising vehicle. We never tithed our members, but there's no doubt that there were members who just regularly put in not $50 a year, but $1,000 a year, that kind of thing. I mean, we sort of sustained. There were lots of people in. I mean, it was not an organization of students, shall we say, living on small budgets. There were people in jobs with significant incomes and you know, a commitment enough to the work that they put hefty contributions in annually. So most of the funding came, you know, from our own members and from fundraising, a fundraising letter every year, and the cinema series that.
And did you coordinate any activities with others, like Oxfam maybe, or other maybe anti-apartheid groups in Quebec or elsewhere?
Oh, I mean, we worked in really close collaboration with all kinds of other organizations. You know, there were organized. I mean, Manitoba Anti-Apartheid Committee was one of them. There was a group in Ottawa that we collaborated with regularly. CEDMA at one point in Montreal was very active on these questions, and we did lots of things jointly with them. There were, in Toronto, other groups involved in African liberation, one in particular in the black community. We had some black members of our own committee, but in addition to that, but there were in other fellow travelers in the solidarity work in Toronto, and whenever we had a liberation movement leader in the city, for example, I mean, we would share the resource with other organizations working on it. So it was, I think, I don't remember it as being competitive, but I know that I was really shocked years after to learn that there was a point when the South African Communist Party, or we assume, or perhaps the ANC itself, but one of the organizations got in touch with the Communist Party in Canada and urged it to form some kind of anti-apartheid group because they felt that Tickelsack was not devoted enough to supporting the ANC. And I guess one of our the other things we did that I should have mentioned earlier, I spoke of the cinema as our main educational vehicle, but Southern Africa Report was a hugely important thing that we did. And there were a lot of people close to the committee who did a lot of research and writing on South Africa and had contacts with people in Southern Africa who also wrote. And so from the get-go, as we expanded to work more on South Africa itself, we, more than other committees, were tremendously aware of a multiplicity of forces in South Africa that made up the movement to end apartheid there. So the trade unions and the United Democratic Front and other people who were academically based who were writing. So we featured their work very regularly, as well as Linda Freeman's annual report on the state of play between Canadian government and what it was doing or not doing in support of the liberation movements in Southern Africa.
Can you tell me more about the relationship between Tiggle-Sack and the liberation movements, specifically the ANC, but maybe others? And maybe what your impression was of them at the time?
Well, we began, as I've said, as a support committee for the liberation movements in Portugal's African colonies. So that meant Mozambique, Angola, Guinea-Bissau, and Cape Verde. But our contacts were by far the strongest with Mozambique, with Frelimo. John, Saul, and others on the committee had all spent time working in Tanzania and knew the Mozambique Liberation Front from their contacts with Frelimo in that era. And John, before he came back to Canada, had actually traveled into the liberated areas of Mozambique with Frelimo. So our strongest contacts by far were with Frelimo. They had a representative in New York, and he occasionally was invited by us to Toronto. I don't recall that there were other people from Frelimo that came in those early days, but there were, because of the immediacy of the contacts with John, his story is that before they left Dar es Salaam, that Samora Machel, the then president or head of the Mozambique Liberation Front, had called him in and said, "John Saul, you're going back to your country, and your people in Canada know about this," and he held his fingers apart for less than a centimeter, about our struggle in Mozambique. "Your job is to go back and make," and he showed, you know, three centimeters worth between his thumb and his finger instead of one. So those were the strongest of the contacts. And then in a variety of ways, I mean, different members of the committee had different levels of contact with different countries in South Africa. Some had worked in Zambia, had known the Zimbabwe movements and the ANC when they were working in Zambia. I took a job with Oxfam in 1976 when Oxfam Canada was asserting its independence from Oxfam UK, and instead of fundraising in Canada for projects generated by Oxfam UK, Oxfam Canada hired its own first program development officer, namely me, to both go back to Southern Africa and generate projects that Oxfam Canada could support, but also to do a lot of travel in Canada speaking about the Oxfam Southern Africa program. So that meant for me contact with all of the other liberation movements on those trips. And I mean, from the earliest days, there were connections. I mean, even in our second year as Tiggle-Sack, there was a Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Ottawa, and Zimbabweans who were living in Canada and knew our committee came to us and said, "We really want your help in mounting something during the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which we think we should call Zimbabwe, the missing delegation." So, I mean, that brought us into contacts with Zimbabwe students linked to both ZAPU and ZANU, and with South Africans who were linked to ANC. So, I mean, there were contacts of varying degrees of intensity with the other movements. In terms of our impressions of them, which I think was part of your question, I think it would be hard to go ahead.
I ask because I know that at the time there was a push to recognize the ANC as the exclusive liberation movement, and my understanding is Tiggle-Sack took sort of a critical support approach, which wasn't entirely in favor, but did recognize the importance of the ANC, and put out an issue in the Southern Africa report that was all about the importance of the ANC. So I always want, but it seems like it was a bit of a debated issue within Tiggle-Sack. Do you recall any of that discussion?
Well, I don't think any of the other movements had the kind of articulated liberation forces that South Africa had. I mean, in Mozambique, student movements had been totally repressed under the colonial regime. I mean, Portugal itself was a fascist country. I mean, not using that term in an inflammatory way, but just a technical way. I mean, this was the situation in Portugal. So, and there weren't free trade unions in Portugal, so how much less were there in their colonies? So there wasn't another game in town, so to speak, in terms of forces fighting for the independence of Mozambique. Zimbabwe, again, not in internal forces of any significance that were playing a role in that. It was mainly ZAPU and ZANU students outside and political exiles outside, whereas South Africa was a quite different situation in terms of the strength of a trade union movement that had re-emerged in the 70s and grown from strength to strength and was playing a major role, fighting, you know, both for an end to apartheid, but fighting for workers' rights and safe workplaces and conventional trade union demands. And, of course, there'd been really significant, there'd been a very significant black consciousness movement with Steve Biko at its head. The United Democratic Front brought together a host of organizations, the churches, the South African Council of Churches had played a major role. So, I mean, there were significant forces, each with their own sets of connections. The churches, for example, you could write a whole book or several about the church connections around the struggle against apartheid, with the South African churches themselves playing major roles in it, but with their links to the World Council of Churches and fraternal links with churches in other parts of the world. So it was this question of focusing only on the ANC as the only force fighting to end apartheid in South Africa. I don't think we saw it as an obvious thing to be doing. I mean, again, thinking about it, Mozambique, a different history, a history of significant liberated areas, of new things emerging in liberated areas around new approaches to agriculture, to education, etc. I think there was a sense of confidence that we were on the right track in terms of support, focusing only on Frelimo, but a Frelimo that itself had not only a role in terms of carrying on an armed struggle and a military capacity, but also social and cultural. They were all poets. That was nice. But, I mean, that was a little bit true of some of the other movements as well. Poetry was not lacking. But in terms of trying to think back to moments of decision-making about South Africa and why that was different, I mean, I think it was that by the time that we were focusing full attention on South Africa, the importance of these other organizations was really undeniable. And so,
what about a Black Africanist, Pan-Africanist Congress or Black Consciousness? Did they have any presence in Toronto? Or did you work with them at all?
No. I mean, I think there were people from the Pan-African Congress, and I think we didn't work with them in any very strong way. They were definitely not a strong presence. I mean, in the era, I guess I have to qualify this a little bit, because I went in 1978 to work in Mozambique in the Ministry of Education, and so I was actually there from 1978 to 1984, and then came back in 84 and began work on my PhD, and then was back again to finish my contract in 84, and then in 85 I was away for another 4 months with Mozambican literacy instructors doing a study visit with them to look at literacy experiences in Nicaragua and Brazil. So in a significant period when the sort of new shape of the committee around the changing forces in Southern Africa was really becoming established, I was out of the picture. So as I'm thinking about how to best answer your questions, I'm realizing that there are gaps in my knowledge, and I better put that out on the table, because it's not as if I lived every moment of that and don't quite remember what happened. I mean, I didn't. I was away for significant periods of time, but so can give you the general contours, but not the details.
At some point, the Canadian government seemed to change its approach to South Africa. Why do you think caused that? What was behind that?
Well, I mean, that's been very much under debate at this conference, hasn't it? And I mean, different people's interpretations of it. And I mean, I think my own interpretation of it would be that there came a point when apartheid was no longer defensible. As the colonies and white minority regimes of that part of the world gradually ended. I mean, you see it clearly in the Zimbabwe struggle. I mean, the maneuvers behind the scenes to come up with a solution to things. It wasn't labeled. It's not just that apartheid was not defensible, but white minority regimes were not defensible. And at the point that big Western powers or capital decided that that was the case, then the maneuver was, how do we find African leaders who will maintain the ship going in the same direction? And I mean, it's interesting to think of it that in those moments in the 60s when the armed struggles were just being launched in Angola and in Mozambique, that already in the university in Dar es Salaam there were debates, and there were African scholars, Fanon and others, I mean, debating about the whole push to decolonization, and really, was it about colonialism being bad, indefensible, something that denied people human rights? No, it was about whether the forces that had established colonies to begin with and were using their colonies as a means of economically furthering the metropole. There were debates in Dar es Salaam about what decolonization meant and what neocolonialism looked like, and how important it was to find an educated African leadership that could quickly reshape itself into being the ones with the reins of power, but saw it as a means of furthering their own lives more than really out of some sort of project to emancipate their own people. And so the desire for tame African leaders who would serve as the conduits for capital, since direct colonialism was no longer palatable to Western audiences, so to speak.
And they found that with the ANC?
Well, there are more and more things being written that talk about all the behind-the-scenes meetings, the flights to Lusaka, we had our moment here of a conference at York where trade union leaders and ANC leaders were present, and I mean, our own queries about, at that time, about Canada's integration into NAFTA and more economic integration here, I mean, they looked at us as if we were mad to be thinking these things and imagining that they should be kind of looking at their economic options within that framework. And clearly, I mean, at some point along the way, they had bought the idea of an ending of apartheid that would kind of seamlessly integrate South Africa into the global system with the same economic interests that had dominated the apartheid regime. A few adjustments, and I mean, some of them hedged their bets. I mean, some of them moved their head offices to the UK, and I mean, in that transition period, I mean, the ANC didn't raise any fuss about that. So I mean, it was just, I think, barefacedly hedging their bets in case the ANC wasn't as tame as they hoped they'd thought it was. They still had the option of, you know, having moved their operations outside. But I think it was that kind of a moment, and many people, I mean, we know that Mandela left his years of imprisonment and the the difference between his first statements that were still in the language of the Freedom Charter and still about nationalizing the commanding heights, nationalizing the mining industry. And, I mean, very, very quickly, I mean, he sort of got with the program in terms of, and it was a program that was well within kind of IMF and World Bank dictates.
Looking back, how much credit would you give the anti-apartheid movement, sort of international forms of solidarity, in bringing an end of apartheid?
I don't know. I mean, this conference has got me thinking about it more, because I guess one thing that sticks in my head is a moment during the conference when there was talk about the role played by the embassy, even in terms of like embassy getting instructions that their job was to be right out there and visible as a force that was saying this has to end, and that they should go to the funerals in the townships, and that they were, you know, given money that didn't need very much accounting for, and to use it for things that would facilitate an ending of apartheid. And one of the things it was used for was trips to Lusaka that would take people from the organizations in the United Democratic Front to meet the ANC. So, I mean, you could look at that as a good initiative to bring the different forces in the liberation movement kind of onto this, getting them to know each other. I mean, some had been in exile, some had, you know, kind of revered the ANC from a distance and never actually met anybody from the ANC. So you could see it as a constructive thing, a good thing, or you could be a bit more sinister about your analysis of it and say, wow, like that was the beginning of the sellout. Like they really wanted to tame the United Democratic Front and build up the ANC as the only force. And many analysts in South Africa now are saying that you know, one of the first things that the ANC did when it returned was to demobilize that broad array of organizations, all of which had struggled to end apartheid. I know that by that time I was working in the steelworkers and coordinating their Southern Africa program, which meant annual visits to South Africa, and that in visits I made there in the early, when would it have been? 95, 96. I mean, people in South Africa saying we had more democracy here before the ANC came back than we do now. So, I mean, their memory, I mean, however violent the oppression had been under the apartheid regime, and it was violent, but this, the vibrancy of the movements that had emerged and found ways to struggle, whether students or whether in churches or whether in trade unions or once the UDF formed, I mean, broad force and you know, innovative tactics used to bring an end to apartheid, and the fact that the ANC saw these people as a threat, like not as a vibrant force to build a strong democracy, but as a threat to their power, and took pains to demobilize them. I mean, we're just out of the last session as I'm doing this interview with you, and I recall just a little interchange in this last session going back to the UDF and the suggestion that, you know, yes, there are people killed as part of that decision by the ANC to really demobilize them definitively and assert the ANC as the only expression of the South African people.
Are there any other, I guess, reflections on successes of the movements that you were involved in or things that you wish you had done differently?
I think the things I was involved in immediately, we were doing kind of at a grassroots level and inventing them as we went along. And there were interesting kinds of collaboration. You know, I recall collaboration with NUMSA in the years right after the formal end of apartheid, where, I mean, they were very aware of South African corporations and their desire now to suddenly stop being the pariahs and have the entire African continent out there as a possible market for them to invest in. So some of the collaboration was with organizations that were doing research. ILRIG in Cape Town was one of them. That was the International Labour Research and Information Group. And they had started during the anti-apartheid years recognizing that workers were often unaware of struggles in other parts of the world. And so their sort of calling card from their early years was small pamphlets about in worker struggles in Bolivia, for example, in a moment when the COB in Bolivia was a very important force. And when I came to know them and when we supported them from the Steelworkers Humanity Fund, they were doing research on South Africa's extension, the extension of South African companies into other parts of Africa. And, I mean, those were really interesting kinds of collaboration because the unions were also very aware of the desire of South African companies to extend into the rest of the continent and saw it. I mean, it was kind of the debates we were having in Canada around the free trade agreement. I mean, what did it mean to have an integrated North America if the same car company that was paying Canadian and American workers $16 and $18 an hour to assemble cars could shift their operations to Mexico and pay Mexican workers $4 a day. Like the good business decision was obviously to move to Mexico. Like, why would you stay? And so the best of the trade unions, I mean, saw that same logic and felt it was going to be a lose-lose situation if South African capital was allowed, now that it was smelled good, so to speak, allowed to move to the neighboring countries. And so they were taking initiatives. And so, I mean, I think there were lots of things that we did that just responded to a changing situation and that we built up a basis of some trust back and forth with organizations there, and we responded to the moment did innovative things. I wasn't in the position of a major policy shop, so to speak. You and I were just speaking as we began this conversation about a group that was involved in looking at macroeconomic policies and, you know, debates about shifts there that would have had huge ramifications in many different sectors. And maybe I was saved those tough decisions. Mine were more immediate decisions around particular struggles. And I think that we did some very interesting things, formed some bonds of friendship, comradeship that have stood to this day. And would we do it differently another time round, or how much there were other agendas than the ones that we ourselves had, how much we were being a bit used by, you know, we ask these questions now. History is complex. There are often many layers of meaning to the same set of experiences. And you just have to, I think, find a level of integrity you can live with in the midst of the decisions you're making, but keep your eyes and ears open and be prepared to rethink it at any moment.
This was an interview with Judith Marshall, conducted by Michael Buechert on March 2nd, 2018, at Carleton University, as part of the Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project.